XXXXX1004. I could not believe my luck. How often did one get a serial killer in their neighborhood? One with a Netflix documentary special on them, spanning episodes. The number rolled across the screen, blurred in some parts, but I could still make out the figures from the pixelated picture. I was bored. It'd be a fun game to play with whoever was on the other end of the phone. Serial killer or joker, as I expected. I had no idea what was coming from the other end of the phone call as I placed my cell phone to my ears with a grin on my face, but I sure did not expect the exhibition of a Netflix horror special in my house just because I dialed a number for the fun of it. The clip still played on my TV. Of course, horror was only the figment of a very fertile mind. And after a third can of beer, I was sure I did not possess such clarity to conjure something fantastic. I chuckled when a plump, red-haired lady appeared on the screen and started to speak with tears in her eyes. Netflix, I snickered. They were all paid actors feigning emotions for views. The number connected, and the phone rang once, and then went silent. I reclined into my couch and basked in the silence. The scene on the screen cut back from the woman to a reenactment of the horrible view with a man towering over another man, axe in hand, and hacking into the victim as though he were a piece of wood. I smirked in disbelief. Hello? A gruff voice called my attention away from the television. What? Are you real? The first words that escaped my mouth were a meaningless babble. Who the fuck are you? He asked. I sat upright when I sensed his tone turn serious. It's not important. Are you Jesse Bjorn? I asked. He fell silent for a while. A while that spanned an eternity. An eternity in which I was staring at the screen with my breath turning shallow as I paled. I am Jesse Bourne, he said. And suddenly the line went off. The silence in the room deepened. And suddenly I caught myself in wonder as to why I had called the man and invited such danger into my life. I reached for my Netflix remote across the table and turned the volume higher to drown what I sensed was an incoming wave of anxiety. The man on the screen now was a police officer, and he spoke in a subdued tone, almost reverently for this killer who had a Netflix documentary. Jesse Bjorn was a man as callous as he was powerful. He had a lust for blood that could not be contained, and he could not be confined to an institution because he had been declared clinically insane when he had been caught. He was compulsive, and he would go after whatever he set his eyes on without stop. He had been arrested and had been freed on that occasion because of his good behavior, even though some officers feared that he may have put up a charade. I checked the date on the production of the documentary, and my jaw dropped. It was the same year. Fuck, I gasped. Suddenly, my phone rang. It was strange that my phone would ring at the time, and when I picked it up, I did so with deliberate slowness. I looked at the number on the screen, and it was a number I was unfamiliar with. I had the better thought to dismiss it, but I gave in. Hello? I breathed into the phone tensely. Max? The caller called my name. Yes, I replied. My phone beeped a couple times and the line disconnected. My heart skipped a beat. I searched mentally through the many people who would call my phone with a number I had not saved on my device, and it did not stick immediately. Then it struck, like lightning flashing through gray clouds of confusion, offering violent clarity. I drew my attention from the timbre in his voice. He had spoken to me only once, but the personality behind the call and the force of his inflection was undeniably that of a man who had some menace behind his words. For the umpteenth time that day, my jaw dropped again, and my beating heart swept into a frenzied thump. I could scarcely make out what was happening on the TV anymore as pure fear crept in. The words of the cops came to my ears, and I slowly began to realize how much danger I was in. It was not a fixation that I was ready for, but I did not have the time to process it clearly because it was barely 10 minutes before I heard a vehicle screech to a stop outside my house. I jumped from my couch immediately and ran straight to the kitchen. I went through the cabinet in a blitz and fetched a knife and cleaver. I pulled over to the wall and remained as quiet as I could in anticipation. Large, powerful hands banged on my door. The kitchen walls around me began to spin. The image of this absolutely insane being whacking a man to death with an axe stuck in my head. My head clouded quickly and a fizz clogged my ears. Raw steel breaking through wood snapped me out of my reverie. My heart went straight to my mouth. I imagined how furious he was, a man with a lust to kill, and he had found me in 30 minutes. Damn. I muttered, realizing I should have called the cops. My door creaked, and the light into my apartment immediately went off. My heart sank. I slipped out of hiding in the darkness, realizing I could not sit like a duck and do nothing while waiting on death. My thumping heart blurred my vision, and as I started to walk back to the living room, I feared for everything that moved. The house went silent, and my heart pounded when I saw the specter of this mountain of a man materialize right in front of me. The light filtering into the house from outside gave him a ghoulish appearance, and for a moment I felt my spirit leap out of my body. I could not afford yelling. You wanna play games? No, I confessed, stuttering. I saw your Netflix special today. And you called death because I'm going to kill you now, he roared. Please, I begged. I don't want to die. There was no time to explain. He whacked, and his axe cut across my face, missing me by a few inches. The heft of his blade packed enough wind for me to realize how fatal that blow would have been. I was no match for him, so I dropped to the floor as though I'd been caught. Ah! I cried in the darkness, and he growled as he rushed to my side. He took aim blindly when he assumed he was by my side. I jumped to my feet, and with my heart in my mouth, I stabbed the knife I held into his neck and twisted in the frenzy. Blood spurted out of his neck, and he collapsed onto his knees. My light came back on when his body hit the ground, and I quickly moved away from the horrible sight back to the living room where my TV had come back on, and the Netflix signature beat dropped. I started to think of what to do with the dead attacker in my corridor as the horror of his face popped up on my screen.
My best friend Gracie and I hadn't seen each other since we both went off to separate colleges. Now that we were both back in town for spring break, we agreed to meet up at her place and have a nice night in. We decided to binge some Netflix and order Chinese. I got there in the evening, and Gracie greeted me at the door. She wrapped me in a big hug and said that her parents weren't home, so we could finally get some time to catch up. We could talk all about our experiences in college. Since the last year, she hadn't been answering my texts and calls as much as she used to, so I felt like I really didn't know what her year had been like. Right away, I noticed that Gracie had changed. She was much thinner than the last time I saw her. Her skin was almost gray. Weirdest of all, she was dressed in all black. I'd known Gracie since first grade. I could count on one hand how many times I saw her when she wasn't wearing pink or purple. You look different, I said. I tried to sound neutral. Do I? She asked, acting surprised. Well, I joined this new club at school. It's all about meditation and disconnecting from negativity. I guess it's helped me become a healthier person. Cool, I said. But she didn't look healthier at all. She didn't look like herself. We sat on her couch and talked for a bit. I tried to ask her about her dorm and her classes, but she kept bringing the conversation back to that weird club. It was all she wanted to talk about. I got the feeling that she'd been brainwashed. I tried to tell her about my life and some of the drama that I'd been through in my college, but she kept telling me that I was being negative. She'd worked hard to purge all negativity from her life, and she didn't want to hear all my gossip. I started arguing with her. I wasn't being negative. I was just telling her about what I'd done this year, both good and bad. Things got pretty tense after that, so I suggested we just sit back and watch Netflix. I figured she wanted to watch one of the new rom-coms that had just come out, but she said she had a better idea. I was shocked when she scrolled to the horror section and picked a bloody graphic horror movie. This wasn't what I wanted to see at all, but she was already mad at me, so I didn't say anything. As the movie went on, people started getting murdered in really disgusting ways. It was just awful. I sat there in silence, but Gracie kept giggling at the carnage. After a pretty gross decapitation, she even clapped. That's when I knew something was really wrong with her. I grabbed the remote and paused the movie. "Why would you want to see something like that?" I asked. "To give me some ideas," she said. My blood ran cold. What did she mean? "Ideas for what?" I asked. She reached into the couch cushions, searching around for something. "For how to dispose of you," she said. Before I could move, she pulled out a butcher knife that she'd tucked away in the cushions. I screamed, just like one of the women in that movie. I should have run away, but I was honestly too shocked to move. This was my best friend. We knew everything about each other, but now she was like a different person. She pushed herself closer to me on the couch, holding the knife in front of my face. I tried to stand, but she swung the knife around, warning me to keep still. "The club has taught me to cut out all negativity in my life," she explained. "That means I have to cut you out." I looked into her eyes, and I knew that she was serious. She shoved the knife forward, cutting into my shoulder. I kept on screaming. "Shut up," she demanded. "You know that you deserve this." "Why?" I said. "All your gossip and judgment, you're a bad influence, and the world will be better without you." She pulled the knife back and looked at the blade. It had a streak of my blood. I had no idea what she was talking about. Sure, we'd always joked with each other and gossiped about some of our other classmates, but it wasn't toxic or anything. I was a good person. Gracie was too. That club must have twisted things around, made her think that there was something wrong with our friendship. I wanted to argue with her, but I couldn't think straight. My shoulder was throbbing and I'd never been so scared in my life. She would have killed me if we weren't interrupted by the doorbell. The Chinese food had just gotten there. Gracie turned towards the door, which gave me enough time to shove her off the couch and run. I ran toward the front door and swung it open. The delivery guy looked like he was about our age. He jumped back in surprise. "Help me," I said. He dropped the food and took me back to his car. I locked the doors and explained what had just happened. Together, we drove straight to the police station. That was the last time I ever saw Gracie. When we came back with the police, her house was empty and the door was open. I never found out what happened to Gracie or what sort of club would change her so much. I still think about her a lot, and I hope that she's overcome whatever madness took over her. But if I happen to see her again, I know I'll do the same thing. I'll run away.
My boyfriend Tony and I had been together for 3 years, and I never met his family. He'd met my parents many times before. Since we got together, we spent every Christmas and Thanksgiving with them. We also went to visit my cousins in California several times. Everything was great, and my family loved him, but I always thought it was weird that I never got to meet his family. He always had good things to say about his parents and his older brother Tom, so I didn't know why he wouldn't introduce us. Tony's excuse was that they lived so far away, but we still could have talked on Zoom or on the phone. I had the feeling that he might not have liked them as much as he said he did, but I wasn't sure. Then one day, I figured out that I had to go on a business trip to Kansas City, which is where Tony is from. So I figured it would be the perfect opportunity to finally meet his family. I told Tony about it, and he didn't seem too happy with the idea. I asked him why, and he said that he couldn't afford to go with me. I asked him if that was the only excuse, and he said yes. So I told him that my company would pay for both our plane tickets, and if we stayed with his parents, then they'd even give me the extra cash that they would have spent on hotels. If money was the only reason he didn't want to go, then that excuse wouldn't work. He got this really strange expression and then said, "Fine, we'll go see my parents." So a week later, we flew into Kansas City. I rented a car and followed Tony's directions to his parents' house. The whole time, he was really quiet. Then, when we were just a few minutes away from the house, he said, "Chris, there's something I need to tell you." My heart dropped. I knew that he was keeping something from me. "What is it?" "My parents know all about you. I talk to them all the time, but they think that you're a woman." I almost drove off the road. "What?" "I never told them that I was gay. So whenever I talk about you, I let them think that you're my girlfriend. So when we get there, it might be a little awkward at first." "You couldn't tell them before we came all this way?" I screamed, "I'm sorry." That was all he said. Very soon after that, we pulled into the driveway. His mom Carol and his dad Steve were standing in the front yard, smiling. His brother Tom was there too. When we parked, all three of them ran toward the car. Tony got out first and they hugged him. I waited a second, a little afraid of their reaction, and then I got out the car. "This is Chris," Tony said. All three of them stared at me for the longest time. I thought they were going to freak out, and then his mom Carol shouted, "My, you're handsome. Come here." And she wrapped me in a big hug. Steve walked over and shook my head, and Tom stayed off to the side, but he waved and said, "Not what I expected, but really nice to meet you." They guided us both inside, and Carol gave me a quick tour of the place. She even showed me Tony's childhood bedroom, which she'd kept the same since he was a kid, and still had posters of superheroes on the walls. Honestly, everyone seemed so friendly. They asked me about my job and my family, and Carol kept complimenting my good looks. She said I looked like a young Cary Grant, whatever that meant. I didn't see Tom a lot because he mostly stayed outside talking on the phone. But whenever he came in, he was super nice too. While we were eating dinner, I whispered to Tony, "Can't believe you never told them you were gay. They seem totally cool with it." "I know," he said. His voice sounded suspicious. "Especially my brother. I thought he'd be angry." I helped Carol clean up after dinner, and then Tom came over to talk to me privately. He said that he'd like to take me and Tony out to see the town and meet some of his friends. I agreed right away, but when I told Tony about it, he didn't seem too excited. "I don't really like his friends," he said. "They're a little tough." I didn't know what he meant by tough, but I told him that he needed to start trusting people. His family was cool with our relationship, so his friends should be too. Tom took us to a country western bar on the edge of town. It was not my scene, at all, but it felt like a traditional Kansas City place to be, so I decided to have some fun. We met three of Tom's friends. Tony acted coldly to them, I guess because they'd bullied him back in high school, but I tried to be nice. We drank for a while, and then Tony excused himself to go to the bathroom. Tom and his friends turned to me and asked if they could show me something outside. I didn't even ask them what, I just said sure. We walked into the parking lot. It was a beautiful starry night. "So, what do you want to show me?" I asked. Instead of answering me, all four of the men grabbed my arms and started dragging me around the side of the building. They took me to a rocky field behind the bar. I tried to pull myself free, but Tom hit me in the back of the head and told me to keep walking. They took me to a giant hole in the middle of the field. It looked like the entrance to an abandoned mine. "What are you doing?" I screamed. "You changed my brother," Tom said. "You made him that way." So I guess I was wrong about Tom. He didn't accept me at all. They started shoving me toward the mineshaft. It was dark inside, but it sure looked like a sudden and steep drop. I had the feeling that if they pushed me in there, I'd be stuck down there forever. I might not even survive the fall. They pushed me closer and closer. I begged for my life. "Don't do this, please. I didn't do anything to you. You never should have come here," Tom said, and all his friends did was laugh. They pushed me closer. My sneakers skidded across the rocky ground. I braced myself, and then I saw a sudden movement to my side. One of Tom's friends had lost his footing and fallen into the mineshaft. And then another one fell, and then the third, but they didn't fall on their own. Tony had found us. He'd pushed them all in. "Get away from my boyfriend," he screamed. Now it was just us and Tom. "You killed them," Tom muttered. "Oops," Tony said, and with one final shove, he slammed against Tom and sent him falling into the hole too. "Are they going to be okay?" I asked. I had no idea how deep that hole was, but I couldn't hear any voices coming from the bottom. Tony shrugged. "Let's go home." He got in Tom's car. Thankfully, he had the keys, and we drove back to his parents' house. Neither of us said anything on the way back. When we got back inside, Carol asked where Tom was. He and his buds decided to keep drinking. Tony explained, they were pretty drunk when we left. I saw them hanging out behind the bar. Carol's eyes widened. Isn't it dangerous back there? There's that mine. I'm sure he'll be fine, Tony said. The next day, I went to my conference, and then Tony and I flew back to California. No one ever saw Tom again. Tom's death was ruled an accident. No one bothered to question us, and since then, Tony and I have been back to visit his parents several times, including last Thanksgiving. They both like me a lot, but they have no idea that I was there when their son fell to his death.